Tax Conference Committee on behalf of Senator Skoy. We thought we'd, in anticipating Representative Dabney will be here momentarily, but we wouldn't take up anything that we would even consider voting on, and instead go right to a discussion of the corporate provisions in both bills and comparison with what the governor had proposed. And I wonder if we could have the staff to come up on those provisions, just go through the ones that affect the corporate income tax. And of course, there's some proposals that affect both individuals and corporate, but we'll look just at the impacts of the corporate today. If they could, Ms. Pollock and whoever does that for you, could I see. Okay, well then maybe the department could provide, could join us down here maybe, and provide that. And Ms. Pollock, we'd like you to join us too at the table. And the corporate corporate taxes are in Article 6, starting at page 28 in the side-by-side. Yeah, the three of you can be fine. So if you just take us through those, the provisions and noting them.
She's not doing this.
When they're different. Who would like to start?
Madam Chair, the corporate provisions begin on page 32 of the side-by-side. And the first provision is a cross-reference, Section 6 of the House, Section 10 of the Senate. Both bills are repealing foreign operating corporations, and this section is a reference in the tax administration chapter, which will be obsolete by the repeal of foreign operating corporations.
Would you bring the microphone closer, please?
Sure. Do you want me to repeat that? Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Section 6 of the House and Section 10 of the Senate is an amendment to the tax administration chapter, and it is striking a reference to foreign operating corporations, which are repealed in both bills. So it's the same in both bills.
And it's also a proposal from the governor as well. So that
is that right?
All three bills are the same.
Yeah. Yep, Madam Chair, Ms. Ryan, who's here with us, has confirmed that's the same from all three parties. The next provision is in Section 8 of the House. This is the domestic corporation definition, and this, I think, is touching on both the House's tax haven provision and the unitary provision. This is changing and expanding the definition of domestic corporation to include foreign corporations that are either incorporated in a tax haven, as defined in the next section of the House bill, or doing enough business in a tax haven to be subject to tax in the tax haven and having at least 20% of its income attributable to the tax haven country, or that have 20% or more of the average of their property payroll and sales in the United States, of the average of, and or derive 20% or more of their income from domestic sources. In addition, domestic corporations that are part of a unitary business must be included on the combined report. So this will require the income and apportionment factors of the foreign entities to be reflected in the combined report and subject them to the Minnesota tax. So what this is doing is it's bringing more taxable income into the Minnesota tax, and it will increase the amount of revenue that we derive from these corporations that are partly located in foreign companies for tax purposes. Current Minnesota law excludes all foreign corporations from the combined report except for foreign sales corporations. And then I will let Ms. Pollack talk about the Senate provision.
And then maybe we can ask questions about the tax havens.
Okay. when he arrives, we'll go back to talking about tax havens. But as I understand it, there's only one state, Montana, that currently has a statute regarding tax havens, and they have no Fortune 500 corporations there. But money is money, right? Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, comparable provision to House Article 6, Section 8 is in Senate Article 5, Section 35, and this contains a provision that would subject some income of foreign entities that are part of a unitary group and that are taxed as partnerships, would subject those groups to taxation. And I understand that...
Ms. Pollack, where is that on the side by side?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, members, it's on page 32.
Oh, I see. It's next to your Section 8, but the Section 35 is not bolded. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, there is some issue with the statutory language and recent case law that may affect the administration and the a policy decision on your part as to whether you would like to adopt this language. And Ms. Ryan, I believe, can talk about those issues.
I understand that, you know, even absent the tax havens part, that there's some issues about the narrowing or clarifying the foreign partnerships language that Ms. Von Mosch has been working on. I don't know if that's available to us now, but we might want to talk about that.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Von Mosch.
We have had a meeting with the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce, and we do have some preliminary language that has been developed that does provide what we consider to be clarifying language. It doesn't change the intent of the provision, and I believe it is still being reviewed right now, and Ms. Ryan will be able to go into some more technical details on that if you want that.
Yeah, in adopting that, I think that if and when we adopt the taxing of them, we want to be very careful that we're in line with the litigation that went on and are not overreaching. So if you want to explain what the parameters of that are, and then later on when everybody's agreed once again on the language that it does what we want it to do, then we can look at that that amendment.
So
go ahead.
Section 35, Article 5 of the Senate bill is comparable to the governor's proposal on this issue. The language is in 290.17, and I'm on page 32. So you're looking at the paragraph that says, except that Section 35 contains a provision that subjects the income? That's the piece I'm speaking about? Okay. So what's happening
and
here?
And that's on 44 in the side-by-side. Our Section 35, if you want to read the description of that.
Okay, so what's happening here is that the bill language requires that taxpayers with distributive share income from foreign pass-through entities, both partnerships and foreign disregarded entities, so the pass-through income that's passing through to a domestic owner, that that income be included in the Section 63 federal taxable income of the domestic owner. So what we're trying to do here is become consistent with the starting place of Minnesota taxable income by starting at the same place as federal taxable income. So we're talking about pass-through income that passes from a foreign entity to a domestic owner and is included in Section 63 income of that domestic entity. There was litigation in a case called Manpower where the tax court determined in their reading of current Minnesota law that that pass-through income from a foreign partnership is not, in fact, included in the taxable income base of the domestic owner. The department has always taken a position that that was an incorrect reading of the law, and we're seeking clarification on the partnership issue. But this language affects both pass-through entities, so partnerships, foreign disregarded entities, so that we have the same starting place as federal taxable income.
Fairly simple, right? Even the side-by-side, I think, is hard to understand the implications of it all. But I think it's important if we move forward on those that a lot of attention is given to the details of explaining the relationships and exactly who we want included and who we don't want included in as we're getting rid of, at least described by some as loopholes in the corporate franchise law. So we want to be very, very careful, I think. A lot of attention to detail there that we do what we think we're doing when we adopt the language later. Since he's here, could he kind of explain the rationale and so forth of the tax havens now? Would that be okay?
Madam Chair, as Mr. Michael's here now, can you also, Mr. Michael, we're talking about, I hope you've been caught up, we're on page 32 of the side-by-side. There were a couple ways that the House considered tax havens for, you know, gaining some revenue there. And, you know, it isn't just gaining revenue. I mean, you know, we keep following the federal folks are doing these studies
and
say,
yeah,
we're losing all kinds of money. And so I think, quite frankly, they're probably a little, the amount of revenue that would be collected might be a little overstated. But no matter whose study you look at, there's a lot of lost revenue to all the states. And so I hear what you're saying about Montana kind of going first, and how's that working? And you don't have any Fortune 500 companies. And so it's difficult to think about really going first as one of those sort of states, but at the same time, you know, and waiting for Congress and what they might do. But maybe, Mr. Michael, if you wouldn't mind, could talk about sort of the two different approaches that most legislators have heard about as it relates to the tax haven. And the governor's had some proposals there, I don't think this year, but in the past, I thought. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
No, never?
Okay. Sort of big picture on what are the pluses and minuses, just, you know, because we really could have gone either way on some of these, but just sort of for all of us to think about what are the pluses and minuses on different approaches if the legislature is going to proceed. And I think it would help the governor you know, think through, does he support doing something here? Because I think there's good arguments for and against. I'm not talking about doing them or not. I'm talking about if you're going to.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. How are you going to do it? And maybe Mr. Michael could just not really, I'm not asking that he take the House position or the Senate, just kind of tell us them both.
Right. Exactly. I think that's very important.
Yeah.
And I will note that our The committee's administrator has had many conversations to date with representatives from the government of Liechtenstein.
We appreciate that.
Very, very assertive that they are not a tax haven and want to get off this list. And I'm happy to see that in the Senate bill, in the House bill, unlike the Senate bill, that the Isle of Man is spelled right, which is, you know, again, we have to be very cautious about moving forward with these things, that we absolutely identify entities correctly and spell them, the names of the countries right. So, Mr. Michael, I think we could benefit from a little history about the tax havens policies on the part of the federal government, and then how that the alternatives here at a legislative level, whether it's either Minnesota or anywhere else, and perhaps talk about the impact of adopting something like this in a state that does not have the Fortune 500 companies and those that do, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, I think maybe the way to start with this is to talk about the different ways that states versus the federal government and most foreign countries determine the amount of domestic versus foreign income that essentially decide how much. I mean, obviously, any state can only tax the amount of income that's fairly apportionable or attributable to activities within that state. So then it becomes a question of determining or coming up with a mechanism for figuring out what the appropriate amount of that income is. All of the states historically have used a method that's an apportionment method that basically determines the amount of income that's fairly apportionable or attributable to that state based on factors that you know, are a measure of economic activity in that state. The traditional way to do that was to take the arithmetic average of payroll, property, and sales of the corporate entity's activities and say that's the measure of how much income is attributable to the state. The second element of that was to say we're not going to look at, and some states do this one way, some states do it the other way, we're not going to look at which corporate boxes you put that into, but instead we're going to use that apportionment formula for the entire unitary business, all of the separate corporations and entities, whether those are partnerships or LLCs or whatever. We're going to put that all in one box and then just look at your apportionment formula's results and determine how much income is fairly attributable to the state. And the advantage of doing that was to sort of thwart corporate planning that essentially puts certain kinds of activities and certain income in certain boxes that result in less income being attributable or apportionable to states that have higher tax rates. So essentially it was a way to say we're going to look at sort of economic substance as opposed to however you sort of sliced and diced your entities. The federal government and almost all foreign countries, I'm not sure about this, have instead taken the approach that we're going to look at accounting techniques and determine where your profits are attributable. And so that creates the challenge that when there are essentially flows within these members of a business group. So all of these big multinationals have multiple subsidiaries and multiple entities. And it doesn't make a difference for their business what box they put it into, because it's still all going to be within the family, within the corporation. It's still going to be profits to them. But it makes a big difference for tax results. And in particular, obviously, what's going on then is that how they make their business arrangements can shift profits from one entity to another. And obviously, if you're a corporate planner, the goal is to put as much profit as is reasonably possible into places that have the lowest tax rates. And the way that the IRS and that, you know, internal revenue from the UK or for any of these other has to attack that is to go and say, look, the prices that you charge for financing or for transfers of intangibles or for, you know, just tangible sales don't reflect what is economic reality. And the difficulty, of course, that they face with that is that there, frankly, for many of these transactions, there aren't any market prices that they can compare them to, and so they're sort of at a disadvantage. So the net result of that is that what's happened is that almost all of these multinationals, and it's not just U.S. multinationals, it's the foreign ones as well, work very hard to assign as much profits as reasonably possible to places that have low tax rates. And the strategy that they use for this typically is to transfer intangible interests. So, for example, patents, copyrights, trade names, trademarks, and all of those things, they try to put them in places that have very low tax rates and then charge the other entities in their corporate group for the use of those intangibles. The other ways that they do this is through financing arrangements. So they will put their financings, again, in these low tax rate countries. And, you know, then the interest or the other, you know, financing charges flow into those low tax rate countries. And so then you have very large profits there. So, for example, you have the phenomena that, you know, some of these low tax rate countries, like the Congressional Research Service has reported that, for example, corporate profits of U.S. multinationals are six times the GDP of Bermuda. So they, you know, that it just, what the reality is that, and that's true of a bunch of other of these small, low tax rate tax havens. It's obviously out of relationship to the amount of factories that they have, the amount of employees that they have, the amount of property that they own, and the amount of sales in these places. But it's very difficult for the Internal Revenue Service to challenge those because there is no market for these patents. They're not licensing them. There's not, you know, there's not like a stock exchange or there's not a commodities. There's no Chicago Board of Trade for sales of these patents. So it's very hard for the Internal Revenue Service or, you know, the UK or Britain or you know, Germany or anybody else to really successfully challenge these. And so almost always the IRS loses on this. So that's the conundrum that's faced by this. Now, back before the late 1980s, many states that have the unitary system that Minnesota has, it used worldwide combination. So essentially what they did was they said, we're going to use formula apportionment for your international operations as well as your domestic operations. Minnesota, when it adopted unitary, did not opt for that. It went for pure domestic unitary. So it was not a problem.
So that's the water's edge concept.
It's often referred to as water's edge is the way that's done. There was a lot of pressure from our trading partners in the 1980s to get the states to stop doing worldwide unitary. And, of course, the main problem was the state of California, which is, you know, as large as many countries, that used worldwide apportionment. The U.S. Supreme Court, in two cases, upheld the use of worldwide unitary by California under challenge first by a U.S. multinational and ultimately by a U.K. multinational. So the U.S. Supreme Court has said worldwide combination is, you know, is a constitutional way for states to tax corporations. Under pressure largely from Britain, the U.S. State Department prevailed upon states to pull back from and not adopt worldwide monetary. So all states went to the system, or some variation on the system that Minnesota has, that says, okay, we're not going to use worldwide unitary. Instead, we're going to use water's edge. And that pressure came largely, I think, from financial institutions in the UK.
Here, he wants him to
report. I'm sorry.
I didn't hear
Representative Benson.
The terminology you used, moving from
after
worldwide
the
unitary.
Yes. Essentially what the system that California and most of the Western states used, they said, look, your unitary, the way we're going to calculate your California income is we're going to take all of the corporations and all of the entities that are part of your unitary business,
yeah,
and we're going to lump all of their income together. It doesn't matter if they're incorporated in, you know, the Cayman Islands or in France or wherever. We're going to lump them all together, and we're going to determine the amount of your California income by how much property, payroll, and sales you have in California for your entire unitary business. Well, under pressure from the State Department, everybody pulled back from that. Instead, went to water's edge.
That's the
typical way it's referred to, or just domestic combination, and that has the effect of excluding. The way Minnesota does it is we exclude foreign entities. Those are entities that are incorporated in a foreign country. And just as, you know, as Jenny was talking about, we had taken the view that, well, if it's not a corporate entity, or the department had taken the view that if it's not a corporate entity, then it would be included. So this manpower case, for example, involved a limited liability type company that was organized under the laws of France. But because it had elected under federal law to be treated not as a corporation, but as a partnership, the department said, well, that's not a foreign entity. Supreme Court disagreed and said, no, it's organized under the laws of France, and so it's a foreign entity. It doesn't matter that the feds are not treating it as a foreign entity. Minnesota law requires it to be treated as a foreign entity. So if you adopt the provision that's in both bills, you would reverse that for those kinds of entities, but not for entities that are recognized by the federal government as corporations. So that's sort of the landscape generally, and there are two ways that some states have tried to essentially minimize the effect of the concentration of a large amount of profits in tax havens. The one approach is the Montana approach, which is what's in the House bill. Montana is the only state that's done that so far. I will say that the Oregon House has passed a provision that would move Oregon to that approach, too. I have no idea whether the Senate will adopt it or it will get enacted, but there are other states that are concerned with this and looking at it from that perspective. And the way that Oregon does it is that if they go through and take countries that have been recognized by a variety of sources as being these tax haven countries, the places where multinationals try to concentrate as much of their income as possible, and say, water's edge is not going to apply to that. We're going to treat those as domestic entities and require you to include their factors and their income in determining how much of your income is Montana income, or in this case, Minnesota income. There's a second approach, which Representative Lincheski had in her bill that a couple of other states use, that rather than going through and naming the countries, instead tries to define what a foreign tax haven is based on the characteristics of the tax system in those countries. Alaska and West Virginia, again, not states you associate with having a lot of multinational companies headquartered there, have adopted that approach. And basically what they focus on is they've got to have a very low tax rate, and it doesn't apply to a large part of the income that's involved. One of the difficulties that the Department of Revenue had in trying to figure out what the revenue impact of that was. It's very hard for them to look at tax returns and figure out, first of all, how many companies, how many countries would qualify under this, and then try to figure out how many subsidiaries would be pulled in, whereas with the Montana, and the, I will say the other thing is that Alaska obviously is a very unusual state in the sense that most of its business activity is heavily concentrated in the oil industry sector, and so it's not at all clear even if in their conversations with the Alaska Department of Revenue if it would make any sense to extrapolate from Alaska's experience to Minnesota. It probably wouldn't, and so that made it very difficult for them to sort of deal with that. So essentially, if you were to go that route, the revenue consequences of this would be even more uncertain than what they are under the approach that's in the House bill. I don't know if there are other questions, yeah, but that's
any,
sort of the...
Any questions? I really appreciate hearing that narrative. Anything the department would like to add, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, members, thank you, Mr. Michael. Great analysis of that and presentation of that issue. It is a serious issue. But I think, as Mr. Michael pointed out, it's also seriously difficult to estimate the magnitude of the issue and how to affect that. I mean, My representative is Representative Hornstein, and my senator is Senator Dibble, so I'm familiar with the issue from a constituent basis. And I get it. I understand it. And I do think that when you look at some of these studies, it is difficult to ascertain how much money is being avoided. And so the department's concern has been, should we lead on this? And we really believe that the federal government should lead. Doesn't mean we should wait for them to, because we can't always wait for the federal government to do the right thing. We know that. I get that. But on the other hand, this is one of those issues where it would be very difficult to enforce, and we are concerned about the revenue estimate as well. The enforcement aspect would probably require the commissioner to go on site in most of these countries to make a personal visit to the headquarters. So I don't think people would like that. I don't mean to make light of it, but it's a tremendously difficult
issue.
And so that's why, in terms of priorities, when we were looking at the package that the governor presented, that's very similar to the House and the Senate, the governor's position was, well, let's do the things that we can do really well and look at the expenditures that we can eliminate and try to level the playing field in Minnesota. And that's why we've asked for the economic substance doctrine. I don't mean to go too far astray here, Madam Chair, but we feel that's a better tool to enforce both legislative intent and to get at some of these issues where there has been a federal law enacted that we could follow. So, you know, we are just really concerned about enforcement, the definition, the revenue stream, and whether, in fact, the states – I mean, I understand why the states are doing this, because there is money being left on the table, but – we're just concerned that we don't exactly have the right tool to do that at this point.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, shall we continue with the other provisions?
Page 3, maybe?
So we dealt with comments on both bills and the governor's proposal eliminated the FOCs, and we've dealt with the foreign partnership issue that you explained, as well as the tax haven. So moving on from there, and I realize they're in various places in the side-by-side, so we'll just let you take the lead, the staff take the lead on where we go from this discussion.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, the next provision is Section 10, which is the general federal update, which the House adopts the changes that Congress has enacted through January 2nd, 2013. I won't go through all of, you know, I don't think it makes sense to go through all of the provisions, but there's a, you know, importantly, the increase in the standard deduction for married joint filers.
We're just dealing, Mr. Michael, with the corporate provisions,
okay.
Not the individual at this point.
Well, the federal update applies to corporations as well, which Yeah, and then let's see, we move ahead. 35. We've covered, you've covered the FOCs?
Yes.
And the foreign royalties, and so.
No, we haven't talked about the differences in the approach to foreign royalties, if we want to do that.
All right. So on page 37 of the side by side, the House bill, right now, just to refresh members' memories, the Minnesota law allows. Receiving corporations that receive royalty and similar payments from foreign entities and foreign operating corporations to subtract from federal taxable income 80% of those payments. The House bill reduces that 80% amount to 50%.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate provision eliminates that subtraction entirely.
So all foreign royalties are taxed, to be taxed under the Senate provision, and I believe the governor's bill or proposal was more similar to the Senate than the House. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
And there's obviously a huge difference in the spreadsheet because of that. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, can we get an update, if that's all right, just what other states are doing right now on
sure.
this?
And, no.
And also, I think this was Governor Perpich is when this started. I'm not sure. Maybe
a Senator
Hogemiller
Representative Rest.
Oh, provision. Well, then you're the perfect person to ask this question to.
There's so many tax statutes that I have buyer's remorse over.
And I'm sure we'll create
NRP
a few more.
NRP is one of them.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But yeah, I think that's very interesting. That, or at least to me, to also know what the approach is that other. States have taken and why this tax benefit has been important, quite frankly.
Right.
I mean, we can call it a loophole or not, but why it's been important with regard to bringing dollars back into the states or back into the country under a tax preference policy. But
Madam Chair, you know, I was thinking, too, when you and Senator Pogemiller and Governor Perpich were doing this, was Minnesota leading on that, or were all the states doing that? And you know, I appreciate your sensitivity and language to use the term loophole seems to be as neutral kind of as you can get around this place. But, you know, I will just note that it's frustrating that often people are trying to, you know, say that these are there's almost somebody out there breaking the law when they're doing, you know, all these provisions, and they're not.
They're legal. I mean,
they're legal tax planning that is behavior that we would expect.
Maybe tax avoidance, but they're not tax
right.
evasion.
Right. So, you know, I think the policy issue is, given the state's piles of tax expenditures, are there some that need review? And given our financial place in this state, you know, do we want to continue these? And so I just want to appreciate the respectfulness about how we're talking about it, because right. often I think we have a lot of legislators who don't sit on the tax committee who often take these things where they should, and I think I'd like to hear kind of what was going on in Minnesota when you all were doing it, if you were sort of leading the way or one of the last states to sign up.
And quite frankly, I don't remember all of the details. And certainly, Mr. Michael and I believe at the time Keith Carlson helped us with those provisions. And he perhaps, Mr. Michael, maybe recalls the financial and political climate. And I don't mean that in a Parson way,
right.
but that. Made us reach out to these particular provisions, and you know, whether it was to make sure that some of those large companies headquartered here, stayed here, kind of here, incentives for doing that, or that's the one thing that comes to mind that would be a natural kind of rationale for it, but maybe he has a more specific recall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was adopted in the late 80s. Following Minnesota for the entire history of its corporate, for the history of its corporate tax through, I think, 1982, was not a unitary state. It was a separate reporting state. During the financial crises of the early 80s, Minnesota went to unitary apportionment, which had obviously, you know, significant consequences for some of the big multinationals that operate in Minnesota, and that immediately caused consternation and difficulties for some of those corporations, particularly ones who had a lot of these foreign operations. And in part that resulted because Minnesota, when it opted to go to unitary, was a water's edge domestic combination state and not a worldwide state like most of the western states were at that time, California, Colorado, except, you know, and so forth. One of the effects of that is that when you're a water's edge state, the only factors that are relevant are the factors of the domestic companies that are in the group. And so if you have a multinational that has a lot of profits that are generated by its foreign operations, when they repatriate those profits, when it comes back as either dividends or as royalties and similar kinds of licensing payments, that income comes in, but there is no factor relief, as I would say. So it basically what it says is, hey, this is all income. And so particularly at that time when we were not a single sales state, places where you have more employees and more property will suddenly have more of that income come in because the foreign sales, property, and payroll that generated that income aren't reflected in the apportionment formula. And so immediately multinationals came to the legislature, came to the governor and the Department of Revenue and said, this system that you've adopted has really increased our tax dramatically that makes it more difficult to operate in Minnesota. The first response was the dividend received deduction that Minnesota has, like most states, is an 80% dividend received deduction. The first thing the legislature did in the middle 80s was to say we will increase that dividend received deduction for foreign dividends to 100%. That provided some relief for the income that was repatriated as dividends. It did not provide any relief for the income that was repatriated as royalties and licensing payments and other sorts of things. So the response was the other little complication on this is that depending upon how you have your foreign operations structured, most companies have them in just purely foreign incorporated entities. But if you have a structure, which some companies had back then, of having domestic companies that are essentially holding companies for your foreign operations, then our domestic combination had some adverse effects too. And so the upshot of that was, in I think it was 1988, we came upon the system that we currently have was enacted, which provided the 80% royalty deduction and the special treatment for foreign operating corporations, which was designed to accommodate multinationals that use domestic corporations to essentially hold their foreign operations. And so I think that the sort of the policy rationale for this, at least in my mind, was largely to say that we recognize that a lot of this income comes in and that the foreign employees, the foreign property and sales that generate this income don't get reflected in our apportionment formula, and so we want to compensate you for that and not tax all of it, but tax it more like dividends, and to give you a sort of an 80% deduction that mirrors what we treat for companies that repatriate this income as dividends rather than as royalties and licensing payments and so forth. And so that's, in my mind, sort of what the rationale was. But in part, as Senator Rest was saying, it was in response to impassioned pleas by multinationals saying, hey, this new system that you've enacted really dramatically increased our taxes. Now, the thing that's changed since then is we've gone from being a 70% sales state to a 100% sales state, and that grants some relief to these multinationals that have, you know, many of their operations concentrated in Minnesota. And so that sort of changes the landscape a little bit.
So I think that is an area within the corporate that we are different on that is certainly open to compromise and discussion as we move forward. What's next?
The next provision that I see on the side-by-side is on page 38, which is section 17 of the House bill, and that's just a definition of foreign source income that parallels what we currently use in the FOC provisions that are being repealed by both bills. And the House bill needs to use this in part because of its redefinition of what's a foreign corporation relative to the tax havens provisions. Okay. The Senate bill does not.
Since we don't have the tax havens provisions, we don't need that particular. Is that correct, Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair, yes. And I wasn't sure. Did you want to go back to the corporate subtraction for dental providers on page 37?
Right. Thank you. Yes.
Sure. Okay. Madam Chair, looking at the same row where we were looking before on the foreign royalty subtraction, the Senate provides a subtraction for an amount that is a dental provider's average reimbursement from medical assistance payments multiplied by the number of patients that were treated by the provider, capped at $25,000. I understand that the department has some questions about how this language is structured, and so if the committee wishes to move forward on this provision, that would be something we'd have to continue to work on.
Do you want to share with us what those hesitations are, or what needs to be clarified with regard to that?
Madam Chair, I believe that we just needed to clarify the years in which the average reimbursement was taken and the year for which the subtraction is taken on the tax form, and then also to clarify how do we count patients, because patients may move in and out of medical assistance in a year, so we would have to agree on a way to count that.
And Representative Lencheski, when the couple of bills we have in here deal with dental work, dentistry, and we had proposals from Senator Stump and Senator Ingebrigtsen, both dealing with critical care, dental access, and we have that in the sales tax provision, and then the MA. And the problem, as it was discussed in the committee, was how discouraging it is for dentists to take MA patients because the reimbursement is so minimal, and that a lot of dental care goes undone or goes uncorrected or unapplied because dentists can't make it cash flow at all because of the low reimbursement. And so, Senator, I think this was Senator Stump's bill, that we adopted try to mitigate the effects of the low MA reimbursement by allowing a subtraction for dentists, and again, it's a corporate thing, but dentists who provide that care, which they don't get through any other kind of break or reimbursement or whatever in other parts of the health care law in Minnesota. So we thought it was one way of helping to support those activities and encouraging dentists to not turn MA patients away, just as a general policy thing. And this was the mechanism here is what came up in to do that came up in Senator Stump's bill.
Madam Chair, I was just looking at House research or a partisan staff if they can recall if there was a House bill on this, and I don't recall we ever heard anything on this. Do you? And I'm trying to. It may be that there was House authors, and the bill got sent to like the HHS committee and died there or something. I don't know. We were pretty good about looking over the omnibus bills to make sure that none of them were carrying tax items. So I don't think it would be in the HHS.
And I'm not sure whether Senator Stump's bill that the tax committee was the first stop or the second stop. Do you know? Did it go someplace else before it came to the tax committee?
Madam Chair, I don't believe it did, but I'll verify.
Okay. Madam Chair, the bill first stopped in taxes and arrived in the omnibus bill. There also was no House companion to the bill.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember anything.
Don't know.
She said there's no companion.
Right. I was just wondering, you know, just a reaction. I'm sure it's a good purpose. Just seems to me there's so many authors who want to use subtractions and deductions and tax credits to really do government spending. And so what
exactly
it costs us is we reduce the revenue stream. So you get the tax cut to who you want, which is really kind of a hidden spending thing. And the finance chairs all love this because then the tax committees have to find the money in their targets. When really the finance chairs, if they believe in these goals, whether it's higher education or job creation or rural dental access or whatever it is, should pay for them in straight up appropriations. So, you know, I don't know if this is one that, Chair Rest, if you feel... You know, because there are exceptions to that, right, that the tax system really is the better way, say, to provide the working family credit. I mean, did you feel that this was the right mechanism to get this assistance to these folks, or was it never contemplated that, hey, the HHS chair on the Senate side should fund this if it's a good program?
Well, I agree with your analysis of how people try and use the tax system, and you know, why not? I mean, it's there.
You heard it here.
To
Chair Rest said, why not? It's there.
The Internal Revenue Code and our statutes, our tax statutes are filled with social policy, and so it's very attractive. We've resisted it for we don't get them so much anymore. The myriad of checkoffs that, you know, we still only have the one that we used to get all the time for food shelves and this and that and the other thing. But we were taken with the creativity of this approach in dealing with a serious problem in rural access to health care, and so we decided to include it. And I believe that Senator Dietzick has a comment to make about it too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Lanchesky. I agree with you on where, you know, this maybe could have and should have been looked at HSS, but we did like the creativity, and I know they've had other challenges there, and I just want to point out that this is not just a rural issue. There are a lot of low-income, specifically minority or especially minority communities in the metro area that are have extremely challenging getting dental care. I know North Minneapolis, and I know in, they're going to hate this, I say this, the Brooklands, this is an issue, and dental care is a problem for low-income all over Minnesota. They have other challenges in rural, but I know low-income in the metro area also has a problem, so this isn't just a rural issue. And I've heard from many dentists, and I represent the U, and so I hear from all the dental students on how this is an issue of where they want to provide care. I know there is a, I think they do it in May at some point, where I know Hennepin County and North Point provide the Smile Clinic, where they do provide free dental care. I believe they did something in Mankato or Rochester in the past year or two where they provide, again, dental care for underserved communities, and so it is a big deal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Senchum.
Madam Chair, I'm aware that there is a critical care dentist in the audience today who may be willing, if we wanted, to be heard, but if not, I know that they have some pretty good documents here that the committee may want for to study between now and decision time.
Particularly for the House conferees, maybe we could get those duplicated and you could review them as we're moving forward too. We had two, I think, really extremely informative hearings on our portions of hearings on this provision and then a sales tax provision, which has very little impact relative to the spreadsheet, but which can make the difference. You know, sometimes cash flowing $30,000-$40,000 makes a difference between being able to stay in business and not, with regard to critical care provision of dental services. Representative Lynchester.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor this item, and I guess what I'm trying to think about is I am sure that the goal here is worthy, and I'm certain that, like most ideas that are using the tax system to fund them, are really admirable. What I'm more interested in learning is if it would actually work, and I guess I would ask Ms. Manzi maybe to comment if, you know, as someone, we haven't seen this, but that mechanically, because so one of the things we're repealing is the long-term credit because it doesn't work at all. And we're giving a big chunk of the money in the cost of the spreadsheet to the federal government like you do with a tax credit. And it's not getting to folks who really, you know, are the lower income part of the market to purchase long-term care. It's pretty much wealthiest folks who do it, and people aren't buying long-term care to get $100. I mean, if anyone's purchased long-term health care, you'll know that $100 isn't going to get you very far. So, I mean, yet all the taxpayers are paying, I think it's $9 million a year for that credit, and we're proposing to get rid of it because if these tax expenditures are not even meeting their goals and they're costing money and they're, you know, ineffective, it's time to get rid of them. I mean, maybe so you can do other ones like this, or you can mm-hmm. pay for it in the HHS bill. But I'm more interested in, you know, is there, not that it's not admirable, Senator Senchum, what the purpose is. I mean, would this work? I mean, would it actually make the behavior happen through the subtraction? And if you wouldn't mind, could Ms. Manzi comment on, she spends a lot of time thinking about subtractions
sure. but
and
you know,
tax credits.
The swap is pretty interesting. Ms. Manzi?
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, the thought that comes to mind with regard to this and how it would help or not help the dental providers actually takes us back to not a subtraction but another credit. One of the concerns over time with the K-12 education credit, for example, has been that the parents, the low-income parents, must incur the expenses for qualifying education activities during the tax year and then they claim the credit when they file their income tax return in the following year and receive the refund at that time. And there's some challenges in just making the cash flow work, coming up with the money to pay for the summer academic camps and after-school tutoring and computer hardware and software and so on during the tax year in anticipation of receiving a 75% credit in February or March of the following year. You, in your explanation of this provision, you said that one of the difficulties that dentists have in accepting MA patients is that it's very difficult to make their cash flow work in order to take them. And I think that this subtraction might have some of the same challenges that are faced by the K-12 credit, because the dentists would be accepting these MA patients throughout the year, and then they would be claiming the subtraction when they filed their return in the following year. And if it's a cash flow issue, you would have the expenditures metered out over the course of the year, and then the state offset to those would come in the following year when they filed their return. So there might still be some challenges there. Now, of course, one might think that, well, the dentist would simply adjust their estimated payments and their withholding to take this into account, but they might not know going into the tax year how many MA patients they were going to treat and how much of a subtraction they would be able to claim. So if the issue is to help with the cash flow, this might not be the most effective way to do it, since it sort of results in a lump sum payment several months after the expenses have been incurred.
Well, and you know, the timing issues are always there when you're trying to give relief like this. So I don't know that that's an overwhelming obstacle for something like this, but it's certainly something that we need to take into account. And, of course, the working family credit was the compromise reached in the Reagan administration, because the Democrats wanted to raise the minimum wage, and the working family credit was the compromise. Well, the EITC was the compromise, and then Minnesota, whenever it was, adopted a similar credit that we call the working family credit. But it was a surrogate for an increase in the, as far as I remember, in the federal minimum wage. And I think it's interesting that over time, the EITC, although it's become very complicated, so that there was a chilling effect on people even applying for it, which is why I appreciate, and Senator Skoy, and I appreciate with your PTR program, regardless of whether we agree with the intricacies of it, that you include an outreach element to make sure that those who are eligible for it get it. And we did do that eventually with the working family credit. The Department of Revenue had a very aggressive program to increase the number of people, not who were eligible, but who actually filed for it. But the support for the working family credit in Minnesota, I think, has had strong bipartisan support. It has not been a partisan issue, and it's seldom been one that's been attacked on policy grounds. It's been strongly supported by both parties. Okay, going ahead, what's left? And then we'll move on to some of the things on the that we started talking about last night and see if there's some things we can act on.
Madam Chair, just a provision that we missed before is that both bills provide a subtraction for railroad maintenance expenses by short line railroads, and there's a companion provision in the individual income tax. This is an instance where the federal government provides a credit for these expenses, and as a result of the credit, there's no cost recovery allowance that's reflected, or depreciation, as we all used to refer to it, in the measure of federal taxable income. And so essentially what these subtractions would do is to essentially provide a sort of a cost recovery subtraction for these short line railroads. Now, as a sidebar, I will say there are lots of other federal credits that have the same effect, and the state has not chosen to allow cost recovery allowances for them.
The governor proposes.
Well, we're the same, at least. What's next?
Madam Chair, moving to page 38 of the side-by-side, in section 14 of the Senate bill, the corporate rate is reduced from 9.8 to 9.0%.
We're largely able to do that with the full repeal of the foreign dividend.
Then, Madam Chair, the next corporate provision is on page 40, Senate section 21. This is a change to the research and development credit, where the Senate changes the second tier of the credit from 2.5% to 3.5% of eligible expenses.
And maybe just for review, could you explain how the R&D credit is currently structured, both at the first tier and the second tier, and the excluded amount before you get to the first dollar of the credit?
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'm going to defer to Ms. McQuay. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if I could just have a moment to look at the language to refresh my memory on how... Sure. How the calculation works. I may be able to recite a calculation, but that probably isn't very helpful to the committee.
Okay, well, why don't we go on and we'll come back.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lynchowski.
Maybe we can hear the House removing the refundability of the R&D.
Sure. Good point.
And, Madam Chair, before Mr. Michael walks through that, just tell you a little bit about that.
Reverting to previous law. Mostly.
Yeah, I mean, I carried that. That was my bill to, there was a huge press at the depths of the recession, bipartisanly, that everybody wanted to do something about jobs. And so I was doing, I was trying to get as flexible as I could and doing things like knocking down all the good rules you set up on TIF to see if things could get going. And people like Representative Dabney and others were, Representative Mahoney were, had to have that angel credit. And we had the historic folks who had to have that historic credit, and the governor plenty wanted all kinds of stuff. And, I did my best to trim as much as I could and paid for the 2010 jobs bill by repealing a tax expenditure, which people, of course, always say we can't do, but we did. That's how we bought that bill, which was to repeal the low-income motor fuels tax credit. So it's about a $30 million credit, bought about $30 million worth of stuff. And one of the things we did in there in trying to review the R&D is we said, let's add something we didn't have, which was this, refundability piece. And, I have to say I know people like it, but I would like to get rid of it, and I hope you will consider that because, we never dreamed it would cost $83 million next biennium. And so while it might be a great tax incentive, the refundability portion is going to Minnesota companies who do not pay Minnesota tax. They have no tax liability to get the refund, I mean, by definition. And I just think with the deficit and the things we're facing, how we can be writing checks to companies who have no Minnesota liability, mm-hmm. That's pretty pricey. And I will say, and I know people, I didn't propose anything this year, but I am concerned, and it is my own fault, about the growth in the historic credit. The next biennium is going to be about $100 million. So when these credits, and I think it's just a good example for people who care about taxes and for conferees to think about and staff, this is hidden spending, these proposals, and they do grow. And the insidious part about them, unlike appropriations, is they go forever until someone has the guts to stop them. And they don't have to be re-voted on and appropriated in an omnibus something bill. They just keep going. So I wanted to look at this one this year. And I would like to look at the historic credit next year and maybe the angel after that. I don't know. We actually, when we passed this into law, and remember, pretty much all of us voted for them, we put sunsets on the new ones so that we'd have to go look at them and count jobs and study them. But this one is just, you know, I understand that you're looking at the piece and maybe Ms. McQuay is ready now that about the tiers. And we actually really weren't opposed to that concept. I think Representative Anderson carried that bill. But in trying to get to the budget number, I hope you'll consider removing the refundable portion of R&D. And just because, again, we do have to make choices. And that really is not serving to reduce someone's tax because they're not paying state tax. And it's a big price tag that's growing really fast. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Lincheski, we are also looking at the attractiveness in other states with regard to this credit, too. I mean, we don't do our policy because of competition, but we're fools not to consider it. So, Ms. McQuay, are you ready to describe that? And I would note that the House provision has a 15-year carry forward, even though it's not a refundable credit.
Madam Chair and members, just real briefly, as you discussed, there is two tiers to the R&D credit. The amount of R&D expenses has a base amount that is calculated in corresponding to a federal calculation. So the minimum base amount that this is feeds into this calculation is approximately half of the R&D expenditures. And so then those expenditures on the first tier up to $2 million are multiplied by 10%, and that credit is worth that. If the qualified expenditures exceed $2 million, any amount over that is calculated at a rate, current law, of 2.5%, and the Senate proposal is to increase that second tier only to 3.75% of the amount of qualified expenditures over $2 million.
Sure. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. And maybe this is a question for staff as I'm trying to think through these various corporate provisions. Is there a relationship between the foreign royalty deduction and the R&D credit in terms of the sort of economic activity that I think we want in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, there's no legal connection between the two provisions. I know that the proponents of retaining the foreign royalty deduction have oftentimes argued that essentially what the two provisions do in combination is the R&D encourages companies to engage in research in Minnesota that produces the kinds of things that can generate foreign income. So, for example, we're obviously a center for the medical device industry. And so to the extent that the R&D credit encourages, for example, developing, medical devices that then those multinational companies successfully sell in Europe and Asia and elsewhere, and that generates foreign royalties, the argument has gone that these two provisions work well together and that they encourage the high value added activity in Minnesota that then provides when those companies ultimately repatriate the resulting profits that, they get a sort of reduced rate on it. The sort of the conceptual flaw in that, of course, is that the foreign royalty deduction is unconnected to Minnesota activity. It simply says when you have foreign royalties, doesn't matter whether you happen to have done the research in Minnesota or Cupertino or Seattle or Boston, you still get the same treatment. So there isn't, there isn't a legal connection between them.
Okay, moving on. Mr. Michael?
Just to go through the non-refundability of the R&D credit, because there's a little bit of a nuance to this that I think is worth.
Somebody else wants in on the mic. Want to go ahead?
Oh, sure.
May I interrupt, Madam Chair?
Members, sure. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to add, I know this question comes up frequently, and we did ask our research department for some information about the relationship between taxpayers that are doing R&D in the state of Minnesota based on the R&D credit that they're requesting, and looking then at the amount of foreign royalties that, right, to see if there is a relationship there. And I can tell you that out of the top 20 largest unitary groups that take the royalties deduction, only three of those company or unitary groups have R&D activities in the state of Minnesota. I could also tell you that in terms of who's taking the subtraction out of the 10 largest unitary groups, about 50% of the total subtraction taken is used by those top 10 largest unitary groups.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, just to, I think you've already launched into the discussion about the refundability of the research and development credit, and so I don't need to recover that ground except to point out that there's some complication here. And the complication is sort of relates to the discussion that we went through before about unitary businesses and unitary groups. And this is an instance where when you eliminate the refundability, you have the reverse effect, that the example of the corporation, the business that divides itself into multiple corporations and has, you know, income in varying amounts of income and activity in one or more of those separate corporate boxes that gets involved. So the circumstance that you can have is that you may have a multinational or any, I guess, you know, just a multi-state corporation that, for example, has a subsidiary in which it does its research. But that subsidiary does not have substantial amounts of profits that allow it to use the R&D credit fully, because the profits are in some other box in the corporate structure. Now, the way the House bill is written is it just disallows refundability and does not allow corporations to transfer the R&D credit within the unitary business. But the complication is that in preparing the revenue estimate that's reflected on the spreadsheet, the Department of Revenue mistakenly assumed that the House intended to allow this credit as a unitary credit, that any entity within the unitary business could take the credit, and on top of that, that they could use the credit to reduce not just regular tax, which is what the bill says, but also to reduce AMT and to reduce the minimum fee. When we discovered this by asking them to estimate how much it would be if it were allowed as a unitary credit, that's when we discovered this.
They had already estimated it.
So the department has re-estimated, and the actual cost of, you know, the revenue that would be raised by the House provision is like between $19 and $20 million higher. So what the conference committee could do is to actually allow it as a unitary credit, as, you know, so that you don't have the distortion in reverse of the normal corporate planning where you're trying to, you know, concentrate profits in low tax places, et cetera, where you just say any research done within the unitary business will qualify to reduce their tax.
Because that's what on the spreadsheet is reflected,
right,
even though
right,
that was
right.
not your
but
intention.
If you do that and don't allow the credit to reduce AMT or the minimum fee, you will actually raise more revenue than's on the spreadsheet too by a small amount. So just I wanted to make sure that the committee understood that nuance.
Madam Chair.
Just
to be clear, because I might have been wrong when I said the 83, and then now it's maybe 100. Can Ms. Templin just tell us what's on the spreadsheet and what the new scored estimate, had it been all-encompassing, would have been? So Ms. Templin has
it. And where that is on the
Madam Chair, members of the Commerce Committee, page 3 of the side-by-side spreadsheet, in the middle of the page, line 59, the removing the refundability of the R&D credit. The initial estimate, as Mr. Michael explained, had the net, and that initially, the initial estimate was $83.8 million that it was estimated to raise with that provision. And then on May 3rd, we received a revised estimate. And this is just the removing the refundability, the R&D credit against the corporate tax. This new estimate shows that it is estimated to raise $99.6 million in the 14-15 biennium. So, Madam Chair, you were correct. And in the 16-17 biennium, the new biennial total is it is estimated to raise $74.5 million. Instead of 62.9.
Representative Lincheski, could Senator Tomparese get a copy of the estimate so that we can use that when we're thinking about it?
That'd be great.
Okay, thank you. If you'd get that to us, we'd appreciate it. Gentlemen, thank you. Are there other corporate provisions that we should just briefly go through, and then we'll move to the other things and see if we can act on anything? Is that it?
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, I think there's one more provision that would be, well, there's several more, I'm not sure, but the one key one that should be talked about is on page 44, which has generally been referred to as the unitary sales provision. If you look on section 36, the second paragraph on that section where it says, in addition, Minnesota sales of no nexus subsidiaries must be reflected in the combined report. Both bills have this provision. It's a governor's recommendation. There are slight technical differences between the two versions that would need to be worked out. The substance of this provision is that, again, back into the way we do unitary, the way unitary works functionally is that each individual corporation or other entity that's part of the unitary group is required to file a Minnesota return if they have nexus. If they don't have nexus, they're not required to file a return, obviously, because we don't have the ability to to tax that entity itself. The total income of the unitary business is reflected on the returns of each of the filing corporations, but the apportionment factors in the numerator are only the factors of the entities that have nexus. So the result of that is if you have a unitary group that has no nexus subsidiaries that have factors, those factors don't appear in the numerator of any of the filing corporations. And so that results in, those factors not being included if they are Minnesota factors. What this provision says, and there are two California cases that sort of are used to define the various ways of these rules. It's the Joyce rule, which is what Minnesota follows. This would switch Minnesota to being what's called a Finnegan state. And it would say that even though the sales are in a no-nexus entity, those sales have to be reflected by one of the entities that is required to file a Minnesota return. And so that would increase the amount of Minnesota income that's apportioned to the tax-paying entities. I don't know if Ms. Ryan would like to talk about this, but I think there's some evidence that as more states have gone to sales-only apportionment and are unitary states, again, this is a corporate tax planning strategy. You create if you have a no-nexus subsidiary, and the more sales that you can get into that no-nexus subsidiary, particularly if that happens to be in a state that doesn't have a corporate tax like Delaware, Nevada, they would
tax
be
tax haven, as it were.
Tax haven state. Then you will, reduce significantly the amount of your income that's attributable or apportionable to states that do have corporate taxes. And this, by adopting this Finnegan rule, that sort of thwarts that. States are divided. Most unitary states are like Minnesota. They're Joyce states, but there are a substantial number that are Finnegan states.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Madam Chair, you know, the House often feels that we should change the House rules to allow House research to answer questions on the House floor during debate when we deal with these provisions. And I think you can see why, right? I'm sure you feel the same way about the Senate Council. You know, there's certain things that happen on the House floor when we debate these that both sides of the aisle say, help. And these are some of those provisions. We've been talking about them for years. They're really hard to understand. And
like the ventriloquist and the dummy.
Yes.
And guess which one is which.
And you know, truthfully, that's why I really am nervous about this year, because at least in the time I've been here, there hasn't been like minds in the governor's office and the House and Senate to start tackling some of these. And so I am really nervous about them, I will just tell you, because we've always kind of known, as people have looked at them, that someone would veto them or, you know, they'd be different. But, you know, so now we've got the governor and the House and the Senate proposing some of these. And I really genuinely want to make sure, even though the folks who are not happy about us looking at these would prefer that we don't adopt any of them, that to the extent they can provide us with language and details and clarifications, really important to me, right, because I don't want to do
and
beyond what we're intending.
That's why we're working with the partnership and chamber with regard, and the department with regard to the foreign partnership language, to make sure that we understand and it's clarified as to what entities that particular proposal is actually dealing with. So I'm not a share of the caution, but it is a case that we have been discussing these things for a number of years, so they're not just appearing out of whole cloth and nobody's ever thought of them. So, okay, is there anything left?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just two more provisions that I think bear mentioning. First of all, that both bills have the disallowance of REIT dividends, which is a provision that's been around, again, for quite a while. Those entities don't get a dividend received deduction at the federal level, and this would conform us to that treatment. The very last provision is that both bills follow, again, the governor's bill and index the minimum fee. That's an add-on fee that applies to all entities, including S-corps and partnerships and LLCs that don't pay the C-corp tax.
Ms. Pollack, is there anything else in the Senate side that affects the corporate franchise tax?
Madam Chair, just one more provision on page 43 of the side-by-side. The Senate reduces the alternative minimum tax rate for corporations from 5.8% to 5.3%.
And that's relative to our reducing the overall rate. We often hear the arguments that, well, the statutory rate, the marginal rate, is not really what we should be looking at. We should be looking at the effective rate, and everybody nods and says, oh, yes, you know, it's not really 9 point whatever it is. But when we make those comparisons with other states, we have to look at not their statutory rate, but also their effective rates. And I think we just need to keep that in mind, that it's got to be apples to apples and oranges to oranges, and not the other way around. And the statutory rate, the marginal rate, it does discourage businesses operating here, that because whatever their marginal or their effective rate is, the additional income is paid on the marginal rate, which raises their effective rate. So we're interested in ways of bringing that down. And, of course, the AMT rate is just a portion of that. That was my first tax bill, by the way, at the time. Representative McLaughlin and I, neither one of us being, or in the minority, neither one of us being on the tax committee, proposed a corporate AMT in must have been 85, and we were so self-righteous. Well, if the individuals have to have it, we don't see why the corporates can't have it too. So it's still there. Okay, we're done, right? Yep, okay. Can we go back and look at some of these provisions? We have talked about some of them before. I don't know that we have. Thank you. I guess we now have the that revised estimate. I wonder if those that care about the provision are agreed that the 4D is ready for action.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to talk to you. Okay, do we have the 4D language that we could pass out?
Has someone heard that? Oh, there he is. Mr. Hines?
Don't tell me it's not ready.
I didn't.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Certainly. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Hines, do you have the 4D language that was agreed on by the players, I think, later yesterday morning? I may have a copy of it, but...
Mr. Chair, I do have. I don't think I probably have enough copies, but I can get some made.
If you could give it to my L.A., he'll come over there and get it, and we'll pass it out, and we'll come right back to it.
Okay.
Just need seven.
Seven, yeah. We can share.
Thank you.
Six.
I
still need two or three, I think.
Is the Representative Dabney. Oh, okay, and that is, we had already acted on that, but let's go back to it.
We actually did not act.
Beg pardon?
We had not acted on it.
We had not acted on it. Okay, let's. Where is that on the side by side where we're waiting for the 4D? Okay, it's on page 20.
Yep.
And it's a House provision. And we had held off on that. Is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair,
Dabney, or not?
We're still, I think there may be some refinement yet to this language, but this language more closely models conversations with the governor and some ongoing conversations on some federal interaction in terms of antitrust laws and the like.
So would you prefer that we not act on this now?
Actually, Madam Chair, I think what I'd prefer is that we act on this with a recognition that there may be some tweaks or polishing
later
that may still come up.
The substantive difference is?
Madam Chair, the substantive difference between the language that's currently in the House bill is that includes a stipulated date of coordination of merger. Mm-hmm. This instead goes to a goal of that same date. This also contemplates a consultant being used to help with some of the research and evaluation. I think if you look on...
this is no state clause at all.
There's no state... The language in the House bill included the possibility of state funding for the coordination.
Mm-hmm.
This removes that. Okay. So there's no state interaction on the actual functioning of the coordination. I know the governor's office has some interest in potentially some state involvement in the consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of the refinement that may have to come on.
Senator Dietzick, do you have any comment about the A38?
I have talked to Minneapolis, and they, I believe, like this. I believe it also has, and I apologize if Representative Davidge mentioned it, this also clarifies that this does not violate or is not meant to violate any antitrust doctrines.
And Madam Chair, the part that Senator Zizek just referred to is at the very top of the A38. It's legislative findings, and while I generally hate having findings in statute, I think on this one
it's
appropriate and necessary. I've spoken this morning to representatives of the two cities and of the two major tenants, and they're all agreeable to this language as well as looking at possible updates before the conference committee were to close.
Okay, are there any questions for Representative Davidge or Senator Dietzick on the A38 with regard to Article 4, Section 23? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves the House Article 4, Section 23 with regard to and the as amended by the A38 with regard to entertainment facilities coordination. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is, section is adopted as amended by the A38.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Do we have a 4D language then?
We still wait. Copy.
Being copy. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Where's that coming from?
Right down here.
Oh, Senator Senja.
I understand we've adopted it. Could I just ask a tag-on question to this last one?
Absolutely. Senator Senja.
What facilities would this cover? Was it Target, Excel, and the new football stadium?
Madam Chair. And Senator Senjum, at this point it's Target and Excel, but okay. The Viking Stadium bill and the establishment of the Sports Facilities Commission does contemplate using that as an umbrella. This will look at that, but does not determine that at this time.
Okay. Thanks. I'm sorry I didn't ask it earlier.
Just salary Representative Lincheski's support.
I may have overspoken. It may not contemplate the going under the umbrella of the Sports Facilities Commission. The Vikings language establishes that potential. I'm not sure that this amendment includes that, exploring that. It does not anymore. It does not anymore. There was some discomfort with that, perhaps future years.
So we're talking about hockey and basketball.
Hockey and basketball and rock concerts and I don't know what all else.
But, Madam Chair,
rodeos?
Just to finally clarify, and Senator Representative Davidge, the Target and Excel, is that it? Okay, thank you.
Okay. Are there others here that we could revisit at this time that aren't? Oh, right. The biofuels tank assessment. Mr. Cummings, how are you coming with the language there?
We talked to the advocates this morning. We have one minor change we're working with Mr. Hines on. We'll be sending it out to the advocates. And I just talked to one of the advocates, and we expect that to be all wrapped up on Monday for your consideration.
You took it off of there?
Oh, okay, so maybe Representative Lincheski, that could go on the list to take up again on Monday, if we have that language. Why don't we move to talking about Senate Article 4, Section 29, page 26. That's on this list. Right. It's on the other one, not. It's the raffle limits. Page 26. And the Senate has an amendment for the House to consider to that. It's Senate Article 4, Section 29.
Madam Chair, there's a cost to that provision.
casino.
Were they raffle?
600. Oh, bingo hall?
No. Oh. Raffle limits.
The raffle limits.
So, what Section 29 does currently is to allow for an exemption to 501c3 organizations from registering with the gambling control board if the value of all raffle prizes awarded by the organization and at one event in a calendar year is $50,000 or below, and we are that was the bill that came in, and we think that is not this probably would cover 95% of the organization, so we're at our amendment bringing that down to $5,000 for a single event raffle. That would be, we think, more reasonable. Representative Lynchewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the spreadsheet cost on this is $77,000, so I think we are past those. And this makes it smaller, right?
Right.
So I'll move the A56.
Okay, we have the A56 amendment to Section 29 of the Senate Bill, Article 4. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And now
I'll move the
Representative Lynchewski moves Senate Section 4, Article 4. Section 29, Article 4, as amended by the A56. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. It's adopted. Maybe we could talk a little bit about, again, the critical access dental. This is a little bit different than what we had before. If you look at page 57. And this is a sales tax exemption. It really doesn't have a huge cost. You can just consider at this point the policy part of it. And we have an amendment. Sorry.
And Madam Chair, mm-hmm. while we're getting that, we have just to put it on the record that I just want to be sure the cost in the this biennium is $28,000, and then my cheat sheet says $17 million in 14 and 15. I think that's $17,000. Can Ms. Templin
that's
just.
That's a lot of dental care.
Whoa. So I don't think that's right, but maybe if Ms. Templin or Ms. McQuay can just tell us so we know before we vote that there's a very small cost. But.
And I'm going to ask either Ms. Pollack or Ms. McQuay to explain why we needed to have an amendment in terms of making this provision really meaningful.
Can we hear the cost? Right, the price tag from Ms. Templin.
We are waiting for a revised revenue estimate.
Okay.
But we could still, I think,
yes.
take the understanding of what the language is. We won't act on it, but I'd like you to know what the impact is.
I'm comfortable acting on it. I just think it's worth hearing what the
exactly.
non-revised
yes.
estimate is.
Yes.
So conferees have the scale, because I think the revised estimate isn't going to be much different. So we could act. Could Ms. Templin tell us what the current estimate shows for this provision?
Sure. Ms. Templin?
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, the Senate provision for the critical access dental clinic sales tax exemption is estimated revenue reduction of $28,000 in 14 and 15 and $14,000 in 16 and 17.
Okay. And I'm sorry. I apologize. I should have asked Ms. McQuay than Ms. Templin, but I think she's working on the revised thing, but I think we're comfortable knowing that it's not quite that.
Right.
So I'd move the A57. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
That's correct. The A57, and then if Ms. McQuay could explain the.
She's not there.
The provision?
What's that? She's not there. she stepped out to get you something.
Is there somebody?
Madam Chair.
It's like we should have these mirrors.
I know.
You can see who is sitting on
Madam
there.
Chair, why is it like this? I always wonder that. I always wonder why, you know, it's, you know, if there's someone doing hand signals.
I don't know. Is there someone who can explain the impact of the A57 amendment and how it differs from the provision in the Senate bill?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Paul.
And members. The provision that's in the bill, and as was adopted by the Senate, originally was intended to only apply to critical access dental providers that served only medical assistance patients. But an unintended consequence of this language was that if a dental provider qualifies as critical access, that would mean that they can't only serve medical assistance patients. There are a number of criteria that in the statute that would are required to qualify as a critical access provider. So the language in the amendment just deals with that language issue. So when we say that a dental provider designated as a critical access dental provider, and then we only allow the designation as in paragraph B, which is on line 1.5 of the amendment, with the further restriction that no more than 15% of the provider's patients were covered by private insurance in that in the year for which the exemption is taken.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair, I'm just a little unclear on the amendment because it seems to preserve the language on 182.9 of the Senate bill after the second comma while also inserting the new language, and I'm just trying to understand maybe the interaction between the new language and the existing language there.
Madam Chair, Representative Devney, the existing language on 182.9 refers to section 256B.76 subdivision 4. The intention was not to have critical access providers designated under every provision in subdivision 4, only paragraph B, subdivision 4, paragraph B, which is why that is inserted on line 1.5 of the amendment.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Pollack, so then there's two tests here. No more than 15% of their patients covered by private, and that serve only recipients of Minnesota healthcare programs, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Devney, no, I'm sorry for if I...
It's me, not you. Trust me.
Representative Devney, the restriction that the provider serve only medical assistance patients is removed. And instead, the criteria is that the provider qualify under 276B76, subdivision 4, paragraph B. That's the first. And second, had no more than 15% of patients covered by private insurance.
So it's a two-pronged test to make this work at all. Okay. Ms. Monzi, did you have any further comment on the amendment and the situation we're trying to address here?
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, I did have a chance to look online at the House's Health and Human Service bill, which is in Conference Committee, and not being familiar with reading their bills, I can't tell you exactly what it says, but it does appear to expand the definition of critical access dental care provider, and it also increases the MA reimbursement for critical access dental care providers. If you'd like, I can visit with a staff who work on that bill and see what they do. I wasn't able to the bills are very large, and I wasn't able to do a comparison of what the House and the Senate do. But I do know that there are issues related to these critical access dental providers being carried in the House's version of House File 1233.
Okay. If you could share that information in a conversation with our staff, we'd appreciate it. So why don't we hold off on that? At
at this point to see what's going on or what?
We could adopt and go back if that's a problem.
Okay, how about if that's agreeable, Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to put it on the record, I think we could adopt it, but check with Chair Huntley and Lori later to make sure that we haven't made a mistake and we can go back again and reconsider if it's wrong.
Okay, so did we act on the A57?
I moved it, but I don't think we acted.
Okay, so we have the A57 amendment to the Senate Article 7, Section 36, page 57 on the side-by-side. So first to the amendment, Representative Lincheski moves it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment, A57 amendment is adopted. And so Representative Lincheski moves Senate Article 7, Section 36, page 57 on the side-by-side as amended by the A57 amendment. All those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. We have could look at the tax court payments. That's one of the items that we also have an amendment on. Page 89 on the side-by-side. This is House Article 13, Section 6.
Oh, and Madam Chair?
We'll do that, and then we'll do 40, because we have all on.
Madam Chair? I believe that provision is now law. This is the House File 212, Yarusso. It's Chapter 36.
And I thought there was a... there was an issue.
Okay.
The bill has passed. Is that not right or wrong?
Yes.
That we had to make a correction to?
So page 89 of the side-by-side is where, there's something. I don't know if it's Mr.
It's passed. It's in law, but it's we need to fix something.
That's right.
I think something technical.
Maybe there. Mr. Michael or Mr. Silva.
An amendment there?
There we go.
Ms. Monzi.
Madam Chair, Ms. Schill is correct that the provision that's in the House bill was enacted into law as Chapter 36.
Right.
Subsequently, the Department of Revenue came to staff with some concerns about that language, and we spent part of the day yesterday researching it. Mr. O'Rourke, I think, has language to implement a technical correction that the department brought to our attention. What happened is that the bill as introduced had three occurrences of the term, let me see if I can get this right, mail in the United States. And the Department of Revenue wanted to change the middle occurrence of that term It had three occurrences, I think, of United States mail, and the Department of Revenue wanted to change the second one to be mail in the United States, because that was a reference to mail that was deposited in the United States, so actually mailed from within our country. And they wanted to make that change to make this all consistent with the Internal Revenue Code and with federal case law. When the Delete Everything amendment was offered to the bill in the House, someone got a little carried away and changed all three occurrences rather than just the second one. And that's the way it was enacted into law. So the amendment that the department has proposed changes the first and the third occurrence back to the way they want it. I visited with Representative Yarusso yesterday, who carried the bill in the House. And she is fine with the change as long as the Bar Association is fine with it. And Ms. Ryan of the department, who is here, visited with the representatives of the Bar Association. And my understanding is that they are also fine with the change in the language.
We have the amendment.
Copy. Yeah, I have one copy.
Okay, so we don't have the amendment, but we'll get back to that. But we do have the language for 4D.
Wow. Plus those threats paid off.
Yes, we did get them.
I heard it correct.
Yes.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Do you want to just give the conferees some more background on this and what the approach is that's taken here?
Sure.
I think you've been closer to it at this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what we are discovering is that as we attempt to develop more economically diverse communities and use 4D as a tool to provide opportunities for low-income housing in areas that also have some high-income housing, when the assessors come through and assess the value of those properties for their highest best use, the assessment of the 4D properties that, for instance, have federal tax credits that were used in the construction and therefore a cap on the rents end up with property taxes that are well above what the tenants can pay and the developers can absorb. And if from a policy perspective, we want these economically diverse, dense, efficient, environmentally positive communities, we need to look a little bit more at the structure of 4D and facilitating those. So what this does is create a two-tier structure to 4D properties. Continues the existing 0.75 at the for valuations per unit of up to $100,000 in value, and then establishes a 0.25 assessment on values above that.
And this is seen as a kind of a general solution going forward with a bit of caution, right?
I think that sums it up well. And we may be seeing this
next
policy
year.
Question come back next year or the year after or the year after that, yes.
Because we're very sensitive to unintended consequences, and so that's particularly why we're looking for them to pay attention to that and provide us with a report on how this would go into effect.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Yes. Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I would like to offer an oral amendment to the A129 amendment.
Okay.
And it would delete on page 7, line 18, after the period, the rest of that sentence, excuse me, the rest of that line, and line 7.19 through 7.21. And thank you to Mr. Hines for reminding me of this. This simply means that the report comes directly to the legislature, and I was more comfortable with that.
Okay. That's an amendment to the amendment, and since the amendment was already in front of us, we can't just incorporate it. So the oral amendment to the A129, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So then we have motion prevails, and we have the A129 amendment as amended to the Article 4, Section 13, page 17, on the side-by-side with regard to the 4D property. Representative Dabney moves the House Article 4, Section 13 as amended by the A129.
Yes.
Discussion of that? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Provision is adopted. So are there others that you can, we talked last night about, and I don't mean to be rambling, but nevertheless, that's what it gets to when we have these provisions now. We talked about trying to help out those active duty military folks that were getting caught in with their delinquent property taxes, and we didn't want that to happen simply because they, distracted is probably a certainly understatement by their active duty responsibilities. And I wonder, we talked about how we could avoid any kind of public disclosure. We probably can't. But I wonder if that
it's your Article 4, Sections 14 and 16. If you have any comment about that, or if there should be some changes there, is that something we're ready to support it? If it's something that doesn't need any amendment,
Madam Chair, I think as exists, it doesn't work for the very purposes you're identifying. If we extend the payment of property taxes to April 15, we push past the date by which their names would go public as being delinquent. And I'm wondering, and perhaps staff or the department can assist on this, if instead of providing them with a six-month window extension, we simply make it a four-month extension. We're still, I think, responding to the needs of active duty military. 6 months is an arbitrary notion. 4 months is no more nor less arbitrary, but we'd keep their names out of the papers. Maybe Mr. Biggerstaff could comment on that or assist us here.
Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair and members, 4 months would certainly work. One of the questions would be whether you wanted to leave the first period at 6 months, so for the spring payment due date, and then just have the fall one be 4 months so you don't run over the time where the county has to publish the notice. The 6 months is fairly arbitrary. In sort of formulating this bill, it was presumed to closely track the Reserve and National Guard deployment schedules, which, depending on the branch, can range from 6 months to a year. So, for instance, a lot of Army National Guard deployments are 12 months as a standard sort of deployment schedule. So the 6 months and 6 months was designed to help those people. But if you changed the fall payment and gave them an additional 4 months, I think that would still get to the intent in terms that they would have an additional 4 months to find a mailbox and be able to send in their payment. So I think it would still work. And the only question would be whether you want to keep the spring payment at 6 months or make that 4 months as well.
You know, Madam Chair, my thought would be to make them both 4 months, that if we make one 6 months and another one 4 months, that we may be sowing confusion. So I could move.
Should we look at the actual language in the bill, since
that would probably be helpful.
So Article 4, Sections 14 through 16 of the House bill, where is that?
It appears to start on page 46.33 and very quickly jump over. Section 48, Section 15 is on page 48.
Okay, so it's three sections in the House bill, is that right?
I believe so.
So, Mr. Representative Dabney,
so you can do that. That's what I do.
Change it.
Well, Madam Chair, perhaps Mr. Biggerstaff can again assist, but I believe that the portion that we would, the language we would need to amend at this time to adopt the 4 months is actually on in Section 15 exclusively. I think the other sections relate to the language in Section 15. So maybe Mr. Biggerstaff could assist on a couple of small changes in Section 15 of the House.
And actually, 14 is just a technical change anyway, right? I mean, it's okay, Mr. Biggerstaff, do you have a suggestion for us?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. Section 14 just includes a cross-reference to an additional section that we're adding in Section 15. And in Section 15, the language that would need to be changed is on lines 48.23 and 48.24. On line 48.23, November 16th should actually be changed to September 15th for taxes due on May 15th. And then it would be, instead of April 16th, it would be March 15th of the following year for taxes due on October 15th.
February.
I'm sorry, February. February 15th of the following year for taxes due on October 15th.
Madam Chair, Mr. Biggerstaff, do we also need to make a change on page 48, line 19, at the very end of that line, changing 6 to 4?
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, that's correct. That would need to be changed, too.
Senate staff, do you have any comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Department of Revenue, that would be you. Okay. Representative Dabney moves an oral amendment, as just indicated, with the change in dates and the change in the time period from 6 to 4 months to Section 15 of Article 4 of the House bill. Questions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And is there any change that needs to be made in order to adopt this in Section 16, Representative Dabney, or is the operative language in 15?
Madam Chair, from my reading, and I think staff reinforced this, the operative language is in Section 15, and we have corrected it. And now I think what I would like to do is move Sections 14, 15, and 16 of Article 4 of the House bill.
Showing that Article 15 has been amended. Section 15 has been amended.
Yes, ma'am.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, may I just ask maybe a peripheral question to this Article 15? It talks on line 4819, as a member of the National Guard or reserve component, would this cover, for instance, somebody in regular Army or Navy or Air Force?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, the testimony before my division was no, that if you're a recruiter who's stationed full-time at Fort Snelling, this would not apply. But perhaps, again, Mr. Biggerstaff,
we had the same testimony, and that it really wasn't needed except for this particular group of the military. Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, this clause was added after we started talking about the bill. The cross-reference to Section 190.05 defines these individuals as people who are on Title 10 orders or orders under Title 10 of the United States Code. And the National Guard or Reserve component clause was added to avoid people who are in, for instance, AGR status, which is an active Guard or Reserve role or recruiter, or somebody who is domiciled here but based somewhere else on active duty service. So this is intended to just apply to Minnesota individuals who are called into federal active service for a temporary period of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So did we move it? We moved it already. Okay. Yes. Well, it's just a further question. Are there...
I think we need to vote on it.
Okay.
Moved but not voted.
All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Anything
else? We
have
the tax court language in front of us again now. Did we do that? Get the tax court language done yet?
Let's look at the here it is. Here it is, the 0640. This is the with regard to the tax court.
Do we have to fix stuff for this? We could do that. We're gonna try to change it. This one.
So this language refers to the timely mailing, and that on the side by side is. Where is it? What page?
Let's see.
Page 89.
89.
Okay, and help me with what the actual motion should be, because apparently we don't have language in the House and the Senate side. It's just in the House side. So
what we're doing is amending the language on the House side. Ms. Monzi, tell me what the motion should be to make this correction to a chapter of the law that's already been passed.
Madam Chair, if you look at the A13-0640 amendment, the introductory part on lines 1.3 to 1.4, you'll see that it's amending Minnesota Statutes 212, Section 271.06, Subdivision 2A, which was added by Laws 2013, Chapter 36, Section 1. So you wouldn't actually be adopting the section that's in the Senate, or the House side, that's Section 6, but merely simply adopting this in its place, because that section that's in the House bill is what was enacted in Laws 2013, Chapter 36, Section 1.
Okay, so we're simply not acting on House Article 13, Section 6. We're just acting on this language to insert into the bill.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Is there further discussion of the 640 amendment? I think we have discussed it before, and it's been explained. Representative Dabney moves a 640 amendment. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Mr. O'Rourke, did we still have, are we still waiting on the MMB fix for the Waubun Ogama School District?
Incoming.
Okay. Wait, are you going to explain?
Thank you.
This is Senate Article 11, Section 17, page 88 on the side-by-side, and this is a Senate-only provision, which I believe we adopted in substance or whatever, but it needed a fix. So, Ms. McQuay, would you explain what the A60 amendment is?
Madam Chair and members, this is the same language that was in the language that we already adopted. MMB just made a couple of fixes to it to clarify how they like to read the language. For instance, it was clarified that the title provide that the lease purchase property must be held by the district. So instead of making page and lines amendments where they felt that language needed to be changed, we just deleted the paragraph, reinserted it here. It's purely technical, that in a manner that they like to see it read.
So the A60 amendment is a replacement for Section 17 in its entirety. Is that correct,
Ms.? Madam Chair, that is not the intention. Paragraph B is still in the language. This would just simply delete.
It's just a portion of it that's being replaced. Okay. Is that clear?
Yep.
Representative Dabney moves the A60 amendment to Article 11, Section 17 of the Senate. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the adopted. Anything else we should get into today, Representative Lincheski, that you'd like to bring
Thank
up?
You. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you want to hear just briefly about one that you might want to think about, which would be the second one on this sheet, holding exempt property for economic development? That's page 16 of the side-by-side.
Senate does not have that provision,
and maybe,
so let's hear about it.
If Mr. Michael could just describe it. It's, again, page 16 of the side-by-side, Article 4 of the House, Section 8.
Okay. Mr. Hines, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, the House provision, Article 4, Section 8, allows a jurisdiction that's holding property, waiting for economic development, to hold that off the tax roll for 15 years, provided it's a city outside the metropolitan area with a population of under 20,000. Right now, they can hold it for 9 years. Or I should say that the cities under 5,000 can hold for 15 years, and the cities over 5,000 can only hold it for 9 years. So this is just an extension of the number of cities who can use this device, and this is in recognition of the slow economic times we've been in, that these cities end up holding this property and have had a tougher time getting something developed than they thought.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Madam Chair, would you say? Sure, but and just a second. We did have a request from the cities, I believe, to look at changing that provision with regard to the population of the cities, raising that to 20,000. I don't know, Mr. Carlson or Mr. Hines. I'm looking for the language right now.
And that was part of my question was, are there other cities, I believe, this language is for out of the metro, and are there cities in the metro that could use a similar fix, was my question.
Mr. Hines, do you happen to have that language?
I'm sure.
The House conferees have not heard anything about this, so it'd be nice when people tell both sides.
I just got one sheet of paper here.
She's got some new ones.
Maybe you could explain, Mr. Hines, what the request was that you brought to us the other day.
See, Mr. Hines.
And why it would be helpful and why it's not an overreach.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Patrick Hines from the League of Minnesota Cities.
We can wait.
The issue that the bill addresses will help cities between 5,000 and 10,000, 20,000 in population in outstate Minnesota. The Barrett legislation was brought on behalf of the city of North Branch because it has some property it's holding for economic development purposes, and it's coming up on the 9-year tax-exempt limit, and it wants that extended because it's having trouble developing the property. There are a number of other cities in the metro and non-metro area that are also running up against the 9-year limit. I know St. Cloud has in the past brought legislation regarding this. They obviously are larger than 20,000 and would like the extension to 15 years. There are cities in the metro, St. Louis Park, Cottage Grove, and Coon Rapids, all of which would like an extension on this. We had suggested creating a sort of window for properties that were purchased during the economic recession between 2000 and 2010. It would give cities who had acquired property during this time additional time to keep them from being taxed. Obviously, if they become taxed, it is going to cost cities more. They're going to have to pay city tax dollars to other units of government, and it just the holding costs become greater, and it's even harder to develop. So there are a number of cities that had requested some similar relief to what the House granted in its bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. So, Madam Chair, we don't have any problem with your Section 8. I wonder if you could, over the weekend or next time around, look at that extension and then
take it. I think we're fine with it, right?
Unless you're fine with it. We think it's reasonable.
Madam Chair, I think we're fine with it. We just wish we would know things are coming.
Well,
when they're not coming from Senate.
I forgot about it.
I think this is coming from somewhere out there.
I forgot
about it. It's nice for everybody to tell us.
Sure. I forgot about it. Yeah.
No problem.
Mr. Hines, did you get that message?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Thank you.
We need to have that,
we can move that
language in front of us, though.
I think it's being copied.
Being copied. Okay. Was there another one that you, and then
we'll wait for those copies. If there's anything else today, and then we'll stop.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, I heard they were saying maybe the biofuels is done, or the petroleum.
Oh.
I'm not sure.
The biofuels
Mr.
is
Michaels
done?
Mr. Michaels said something to me.
Mr. Michaels?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the petroleum tax provisions in the DOR bill. There are provisions in both bills. It's on this sheet. It's the last item on page 2. Article 18, Section 7 and 8 of the House bill, Article 16, Section 7. The department has also come forward with additional technical changes to other sections of the statute that I believe. Do they have copies of this?
Okay. I don't know where we're looking.
112.
What's
it? It's not it.
I don't see it.
Side by side,
112.
On this one. But is it on this list?
Yes, on this
list. Oh, it's on the little page. That's where it went.
Yeah, that's not it.
112 is the side by side.
Not a word. It's the A13.
Yeah.
No, this is the tip. Madam Chair, they do have the Senate staff have copies, and they will on this petroleum tax thing, they will hand them out shortly, and you can act on that.
So we have a handout on that, then?
But we don't.
Thank you.
That's true.
Yes, they thought it already.
Yeah, makes sense.
Thank you. And so this is with regard to page 112, articles 18, section 7 and 8, and this now includes the fix for that the DOR has made with commerce and agriculture. That's what is reflected in the 642 amendment. Is that correct, back there? Representative Mancheski, any questions?
Madam Chair, I think that what you should be adopting is House Section 7, Senate Section 8, plus the amendment.
House Section 7.
Okay, so we...
Senate Section 7, not... Yep. All right. House
Say it again.
Madam Chair, it's adopt House Section 7, Senate Section 7 instead of House Section 8 plus the amendment.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, right.
Yes,
there is
go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, if I can move then, I think this is right. House Article 18, Section 7.
Right.
Senate Article 16, Section 7. And the A13-0642 amendment.
That is the motion. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Then we have this, and that would go, where was that on the side by side again?
16.
These, we would amend. Article 4, Section 8 would be amended by, we have to give this some sort of title, this amendment. How about just calling it the amendment AAA? Okay. So Representative Lincheski moves the AAA amendment to the Article 4, Section 8. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Then Representative Lencheski moves Article 4, Section 8, as amended by the AAA. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
What I see is Angel Minor is the only one I even see on here.
Angel Minor? Can we just take care of that? That's not going to change anything regardless of what we do. Okay, let's look at, where is that, Representative Lencheski? Pages 29 and 30?
Yes.
Yep.
It's the only one I can see. Better. I think it's your staff telling us what's better.
29 and 30. Ms. McQuay or Ms. Pollock, what's the difference between the two in terms of the technical amendments?
Madam Chair, just one moment. We're just looking at those.
Too,
when they're done, tip them her.
Okay. Ms. Manzi, you want to comment on it, and then we'll, or Mr. Michael, whoever over there, and then we'll see if we have any difference of opinion on the Senate side.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, this motion would simply relate to the technical changes with the Angel Credit and not to the expansion to the targeting to Greater Minnesota. So in Article 6, Section 1 of the House, that Section 1 of the House contains the technical changes. The comparable Senate section contains the technical changes and also a cross-reference related to the targeting to Greater Minnesota. So the motion, if you take it up, would not include that Greater Minnesota piece. And those two are the same otherwise. The next section is House Section 2, Senate Section 3. And again, here there is a difference where the Senate contains language relating to Greater Minnesota, so it would not include that. But there also is a difference with regard to the technical changes that came from Deed, and that is that the House extends the number of years in which a business may have been in operation to qualify as a business to receive investments that will get the Angel Credit from 10 years to 20 years for businesses that are engaged in researching, developing, or producing drugs or medical devices that require U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval. The rationale for that is that the drugs and medical devices often take a very long time to go through the testing and approval process, and those particular kinds of businesses are thought to be startup businesses for a longer time than other businesses that would qualify for the Angel Credit. So that's the difference in those two sections that you'll need to consider. And then the third section is House Section 3, and there is no comparable Senate section. And this, again, is a provision brought by Deed that would allow more disclosure of information on businesses that receive investments. Under present law, only the name of the business may be disclosed, and this would also allow the mailing address, telephone number, email address, contact person's name, and industry type to be disclosed. So this is providing more information about to the public about the businesses that are getting investments that then qualify for the credit for the investors.
Ms. Pollock, any comment?
Madam Chair, the data privacy provisions in the House bill were heard in, I believe, two Senate bills, and they were not acted on in the Tax Committee, but were adopted in a provision by the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Dietzick, did you take up those provisions in your data privacy bill?
Madam Chair, I don't believe they were in my bill. There were a few other bills that were separate. ran separately. Omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, in the House...
Ms. Manzi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the House, there was discussion in the Tax Committee with Chair Lesh, of the who does the civil law in the House, and he did not believe that the data practices group in the House needed to see this provision, so it remained in the Tax Committee.
Okay, I don't think we have any problem with that. So the language... okay, so let's maybe do this in parts.
Yeah.
So the first motion would be I'll call it the first paragraph of Article 6, Section 1, which is the definition change with regard to liquidation events in the House and Senate are the same. So Representative Dabney moves that.
Please.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Then we would move to nothing else in that provision at this point, to Article 6, Section 2, and the what is the sense? It says some minor language differences. Ms. Pollack, can we go with the House language?
Madam Chair,
I think that the 20 years is the substantive.
Representative Lencheski?
While your staff is looking, I think the way I heard it, it's this 10 to 20 years is the substantive part for these folks that are trying to gain FDA approval. I don't know if your staff has.
No, I'm not talking about
that.
I'm talking
one.
About the second two bullet points. I guess the first one is fine. We don't have
okay.
it, but the second
so the
two have
two.
Language differences, and I'm just asking for
right.
their
okay.
opinion
okay.
on that language differences.
Madam Chair,
no
yes, the Senate language differences are minor, so if the committee wishes to adopt House Article 6, Section 2, the second two bullet points.
And what about the first one?
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I would have no comment on that. It's just that we didn't include this provision in our bill.
Yeah, again, just briefly, what the first bullet point is a response to.
Ms. Manzi's.
Yeah, just very briefly again, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a recommendation from DEED relative
Indeed.
To businesses that need to get FDA approval of their products. The basic contention is that takes a longer period of time. And so they ought to be considered startup businesses for the 20 years rather than 10 years.
Okay, so the next motion then, Representative Dabney, will be the first three bullet points on Article 6,
so
Section
moved.
2 of the House. We'll come back to our Section 3 later with a fuller discussion of the Angel Investment Credit. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and those bullet points are in Article 6, Section 2 are
What's that?
Adopted. And then Senator Dietzick, did you look at that Article 6, Section 3? What's your opinion on that?
Article 5 of the Senate now, Section 3. Okay. Right.
Well, I was looking at the permitted disclosure article. What is that up there at the top?
I think it's Article 5 at the top. Same page, Section 3 of the Senate at the very bottom.
Senate side.
Well, it's
Senate
not.
Senate side.
There should,
yeah, Section 3.
There's no comparable. Am I looking? I'm looking
page
at.
29.
Article 6, Section 3, right?
Page 29, are you on?
Madam Chair,
no,
are you referring to
30.
The data provisions?
At 29, the very bottom of the Senate side. We're just looking on the wrong page.
Okay. So my question would be with regard to the bullet point on Section 3 of the Senate side, for which there is no comparable provision, is that tied up with our proposal with regard to the Angel Investment Credit in the Greater Minnesota, and so we should hold off on acting on that. And then I was going further to what, so we don't want to act on that yet. And
I didn't think it was, actually. I thought it was separate.
Well, that was why I was asking. Because you don't have it. Is that a technical correction, too, or is that a policy change that you're okay with, or what?
Yeah, on the minor, that's in there for the Senate versus the Greater Minnesota. Oh, I see they're on both.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're going to hold off on that bullet point. But then you have in Article 6, your Section 3, the data issue, Senator Dietzick, that's on page 30, that we have no comparable position. I'm just trying to clear that one up.
Madam Chair, yes, we did hear that on judiciary, in the Judiciary Committee, and it did pass out. And it was referred to the Jobs Committee, but I don't believe it made it out of the Jobs Committee, but it did make it out of Judiciary, so I think we were fine with it.
Okay, Senator Representative Dietzick moves on the House, Article 6, Section 3. Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
And now Representative Dabney has something else here.
Yeah. Looking at the side-by-side on page 30, the effective date on the provisions related to FDA approval were different between the two bodies, and I'm just wondering if we need to deal with that today or reserve that for later time or how you...
This is regard to the... effective date of what?
Of the language regarding FDA approval that we just approved.
On the previous page.
Yes. So the provision is on page 29. This is just a difference between the two bodies. On effective date, the House has it effective June 30. The Senate has it effective day following final enactment.
What would be a reason not to adopt this?
Yeah.
Ms. Manzi?
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the Conference Committee, the House provision related to the drugs and medical devices requiring FDA approval was unique to the House and not carried in the Senate. Indeed, had proposed an effective date for that provision of the day following final enactment, and I think the reasoning for that is that since the Angel Credit is a capped amount for the year, they wanted these businesses to be able to qualify following final enactment of the bill rather than to wait to put in their applications for this year's allocation until after June 30th of the year. The other House provisions, the bullet points, which were the same except for minor language differences, so the second two bullet points, the House had effective for businesses that are certified after June 30th, 2013, and the Senate had effective the day following final enactment. My recollection is that the House was following the deed proposal, but I'm not 100% certain for that. The Senate staff may know why the Senate had those provisions effective a little earlier.
Madam Chair, I believe this Senate... language to make these provisions effective the day following final enactment were taken from the bills as they were heard in the committee, but if Deed has another recommendation, I don't know that.
They don't want that in the committee.
And Madam Chair, I would just add that the difference between starting it effective immediately and starting it in the next fiscal year is that that even though the program is capped, there will be distributional effects among those that receive the credit when you enact something the day following final enactment versus starting it in the next fiscal year. And maybe Ms. Templin can verify if she's reading that the same way. And that's a decision for the committee to make. Thing.
So what is this amendment?
Unrelated.
To this kind of technical.
I was just getting that.
Okay. Okay, what's your pleasure?
Well, if it's a money thing, then I think we have to care.
Well, Ms. Templin or
Ms. McQuay is saying.
Does it affect the money?
Well,
Madam Chair, no, it doesn't affect. It's a capped program. It would just affect if you're making the decision going forward or if you're making it for distributional effects in this fiscal year.
Madam Chair, I was notified yesterday by someone outside the legislature that all of the money for the ANGEL program for this fiscal year has been distributed at this time, and I'm getting confirmation from folks in the room. So I'm not sure then it would have any effect. Money's gone.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, then you could do either one.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one exception to that is this liquidation event language, because if you have a business that received a certified amount of money and they intend to do a public offering within that window of time, that this provision would disqualify them. And I think that is why Deed had originally requested the July 1st effective date, so that essentially if that language were to capture someone who had planned to do a public offering within that window, it would not disqualify them. I don't know, you know, if you do it day following final enactment, chances are there's nobody that's, you know, planning that, but that's the only potential effect, I think, between the two different effective dates.
Well, it seems then that the June 30 effective date would be the clearest.
Okay. Okay.
With the least potential downside of unanticipated consequences.
So with regard to your section 2 of Article 6, shown now on page 30 of the side-by-side, the effective date for the ANGEL investment mm-hmm. credit, we will go with you're moving the House language.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Is that clear?
Yep.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We have one final thing, and then we're going to be done.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hines gave me the A-126 amendment. My understanding is that this is strictly technical at the request of MMB. Okay. It impacts county program aid, and while we're not doing county program aid, this is strictly technical and something we could
okay,
do.
So what is it, where is it in the, what is it amending in the side-by-side?
Mr. Hines, can you assist, please?
Let's see. It's in House Article 3, Section 18.
Where's that on the
page 39 of the House bill.
Without the side-by-side.
Page 11 of the side-by-side.
Go ahead. What is it now? Which section was it?
Section 18 of the House, Section 13 of the Senate, but it's drawn to the House language, so it fits into the House bill.
He's got copies.
Is there any discussion?
What's the change?
Representative Dabney moves the A-126 to the, as technical language, to Article 3, Section 18,
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We're not acting on that section because it's just a technical amendment to it when we end up adopting the program aid.
And that's right. Understood. Madam.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else today? Thank you very much for the conversation on the corporate. And I think,
Madam Chair,
we've just 1 second. We've gotten we've had some very productive discussion on some of these little things so that they get out of the way where we're more likely to be attuned to them. Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, I just want to follow up on your comments. It's just been amazing. I just want to comment on the interrelationship and the work between the department, the House staff, and the Senate staff. These last few days, I know we're not done, and we have a lot more to do, but the last couple of days, the technical nature of what they've accomplished is pretty amazing. And just wanted to say thank you to everybody.
We have great staff.
Yep.
Yes, we do.
Representative Lincheski, we have the marriage bill on Monday, and don't know exactly what our schedule will be with regard to that. I think we are going in and caucusing nine-ish, ten, nine. I can read fingers at nine, and then we'd be going on the floor and being there until the action is taken on the bill. So I'm not sure when we would be available, but we certainly want to continue meeting and later in the afternoon or whenever. Your pleasure. What is the House schedule? We can talk to Senator Scoy about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were just looking in the House. Looks like the House is going on the floor at 11 and the Senate at 12. And so we heard you have caucus. I guess, you know, we could stay tuned and see if you have time to meet between caucus and the floor, but it sounds like you don't. But, you know, there could be a 10:30 if you went to caucus at 9 and you're on the floor at 12, but if not, and that passes by, then I think after the Senate off the floor would be my guess. Okay. But Madam Chair, if I may, I just
we'll
think
look for a window in the morning, though.
It'd be
you.
Nice.
Yeah, I agree.
But Madam Chair,
we have
if
to
I may,
get those targets.
Yeah. All these little detailed provisions, I know people are still working on language. I think you agree that people just have to get them done. Because when the targets come out, we're just going to be so past this stuff.
Right.
And for people who care about these things, they just we've spent, I think, we've had a lot of great days of actually being productive and getting a lot done. But we're going to shift focus here real fast. And so even if we're not meeting Monday morning, people can be working on all this language and getting things ready and emailing people amendments and all that stuff.
And Madam Chair, I am a firm believer that the members of the conference committee should pass their eyes over technical amendments to any of the provisions that are in here, because ultimately it is we who are responsible for them. So I know it's sometimes the custom to just direct staff to do something. I resist that. I want to see the words on the page. And I know that Senator Scoy maybe even feels stronger. So with that, I hope everyone has a nice afternoon, and we'll see you on Monday, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.